You are now listening to the Major League Real Estate Podcast, episode 13. Welcome to the Major League Real Estate Podcast, a podcast for operators of large-scale real estate portfolios. My name is Brandon Hall, and I'm your host. Together with my co-host, Dylan Brown, we talk about tax and legal strategies, and we bring on operators of large portfolios for in-depth discussions on how they grew their business. We hope you enjoy, and with that, let's get to it. Welcome to another episode of the Major League Real Estate Podcast. I'm here with my co-host, Dylan Brown. How are you doing today, Dylan?
Doing awesome, man. It's, what are we sitting at? February 28th. So it's a leap year. So we actually have another day of February. I was about to say tomorrow is March. So that's like crunch time for us in tax, but we've got an extra day of February. So that's actually probably going to, you know, tip the needle a little bit. We're going to get some stuff done in February yet.
one extra day for filing taxes. I love that. Although I guess we're not really filing many returns at this point because of that bill that's going through Congress. And I know that we've got an update on that. Do you want to run through it?
Sure thing. But first, I got to ask, how are you doing? I mean, I know I'm in the trenches. I mean, what's it like in Brandon Hall's world right now?
I'm good, man. It's very busy. We have aggressive growth goals, as always. We've hired a great team to fulfill the growth goals. We tend to do that now. It's nice. We weren't always like this, but now we have data that we make hiring decisions on. So we pre-hire the team that we need in like 8 to 12 months. So now it's just trying to fill up those plates and make sure that everybody's got enough stuff to do. But yeah, no, it's good. That's where I'm spending a lot of my time at this point.
Wow. You summed up. It makes it sound like easy. Like you snap your fingers.
Yeah,
you
know? Well, it's definitely not easy, but that's what I'm focusing on. In other news though, personal news, I have a grade 2 ankle sprain. So you can't see me right now, but I'm in a boot. I was on crutches all last week.
Jeez.
It's really not a fun story, not a funny or great story either. I was playing soccer outside with my 4-year-old and I did a turn, rolled my ankle over the ball and just, whoosh, it was pretty terrible.
Oh man. I hope it didn't make that noise. Oh
it
gosh.
It kind of did. Yeah. It's like a little pop, you know, sorry if anybody's squeamish listening to this, went to the ortho pretty immediately. I mean, it swelled up like a balloon. I got freaked out because I've never broken a bone. I've never had an injury like this, even though I played like competitive sports growing up. So I've been lucky in that regard. But I guess my body's just too frail at this point to really keep playing. But yeah, I went to the ortho and, you know, the doc's like, okay, does there hurt here? I'm like, nope, here, nope, here, nope, here. Yep, that hurts. And he's like, okay. And he just keeps pressing it. And I'm like, no, dude, you found it. That's where it is. And he's just like, all right, what about now? I was like, oh. man, I've been on crutches.
Gosh.
First time I've ever been on crutches for the past week and a half. And that was terrible. The worst thing about my entire body hurt with the crutches because your armpits hurt. Like I was like working out muscles that I haven't touched in years. You know, it's like everything's just sore and my butt was sore because I'm like having to scoot down the stairs. I can't like walk downstairs. You got to like get on your butt and like boom, boom. Yeah.
I'm surprised you didn't get one of those like old person little elevators that you sit on at the top of the stairs.
I thought about it. Yeah. Oh, I felt so bad for my wife. She's such a champ too, because she's taking care of the kids and then basically me, a vegetable sitting on the couch all day. But I couldn't move and it sucked. So very thankful to be in a boot. And now I can walk without crutches. So I feel like a new man. And I've got to be in this for like 72 hours, and I can take this off and hopefully maybe walk. I'm scared to walk on it, though. It's like every time I take the boot off, I'm like, I get nervous. So I don't know. It's like my foot's going to fall off or something.
Well, that's exciting. excited for you.
Okay.
You know, you take that for granted, I guess, walking.
But
to get into it a little bit, your question, what's our big update? Well, the update is that we don't really have an update. The update is that we're still in a holding pattern. So as you mentioned, going into this, we've got dozens, hundreds of returns just at our firm where we're seeing possibly bonus eligible property, which we've already touched in prior episodes. But if you didn't listen to those episodes, there's a bill. It was passed by the House, right? And it's sitting with the Senate for a vote to return to 100% bonus depreciation retroactive to the beginning of 2023. Huge deal. That's not the only thing in the bill, but that's kind of what our clients are focused on, right? Huge deal. It just seems like the date at which we can expect that to really have any movement keeps being pushed back. And Nathan Sosa, who we've had on our podcast before, he's been internal here tracking that for us. And he keeps giving updates. And the latest update is it sounds like the soonest might be April 15th now. We were hoping to see something move in early March, but now we're seeing a possible not until April 15th. Which obviously that pretty much pushes any partnership, any individual, any S corp, any entity really, or person that has the bonus eligible property in 2023 kind of pushes us out even beyond into the point where we're going to need extensions, right? That's really what the key takeaway here is. It's starting to look like extensions in those scenarios are almost a necessity. Otherwise, we'll be guessing if we're filing before then.
Yeah. So we were hoping that it was going to be done, just to reiterate, March, early March, right around now. But the Senate was on recess for the past 2 weeks. So now it is looking like it's not going to be done until April 15th. So if you're listening to this and you have a ton of investors, you just need to update them, keep them in the loop, and explain why it's important that we don't file right now, right? Like, if you're getting a cost segregation study performed, if you are utilizing bonus depreciation, make sure that you remind them of that whenever you are communicating to your investors, because investors want to file on time. Like, we all grew up going to school and you get penalized if you turn your homework in late, right? We have this like innate need to file on time. But if you have the bonus depreciation, you really should wait. So just make sure that you are communicative to your investors about that. But today's topic is carried interest. Why don't we just start off with, what is carried interest? Can you explain that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I like to start with the definition, right? A carried interest literally is, it's a share of profits from private equity. It's not just private equity. We've got venture capital, hedge funds, real estate funds, and syndications. So that's where our clients and our listeners come in. But really, if you think about a type of fund that has some sort of active management, carried interest is designed to compensate the managers, but aligning the interest with the investors. So a carried interest is typically only paid if a fund or syndication achieves a specific minimum return, in a lot of cases has returned initial investment back to those investors. And then a portion of the proceeds above that get to partially go to the manager or the general partner. So that's like at its essence what a carried interest is. There's a lot of different flavors. Like in our clientele and our listener base, we see a lot of them where there's like a preferred return first going to the investors. And then after that's been paid, you know, there's typically some splits, and splits vary widely, right? In hedge funds, it's like 20% carry is typical. So that would be an 80-20 split, put differently. You know, in real estate, we might see splits 70-30 or 50-50 even in some cases. So it's very dependent on the industry as well and the risk tolerance of all the parties involved, things of that sort. So that's like the definition of a carried interest.
Cool. Now, you did a bunch of research on the history of carried interest. I've actually never seen this before. So walk us through that. It's super interesting. For a tax.
Yeah, rate, I guess. I thought so too. So as with pretty much anything, you know, you look broader picture, like the modern financial industry, modern financial constructs that we have today, a lot of it goes back to like shipping. And like, if you think about the history of the corporation, and then you look at like the Dutch East India Company and things like that, there's a lot of these things that get linked back to shipping, and carried interest is in that same boat, pun intended. So what you see here is carry. And I'm not sure if this is why it's called a carried interest, but my research lends me to believe that it is. So it's actually a compensation for the captain and the crew of a ship to carry whatever was on the ship to its destination. And then once it's sold, if it was a profitable journey, then they get an upside, a little carried interest. That's where the term originates. It's to align the incentive of the ship owners who are taking on risk by investing in these things, and they want it to go well. So they want managers or crew members in this case to steward their investment, right? And they get an upside if it goes well. So that's where, as far as my research has landed, that's where the carried interest originated. And then you fast forward into, you know, the dawn of private equity and hedge funds and all these more nuanced financialized ways of, you know, aggregating investor funds and deploying it into businesses versus just basic capital markets and basic small business owned by mom and pop. Then you see a transformation where carried interest is applied. And instead of crew members and captains of ships, you got GPs, hedge fund managers, managers of private equity funds, and they want to steward the investor in those funds' capital and in a way that incentives are aligned with the interest of the investor. And so that's when you see, you know, carried interest being applied to the modern day financial sector. Obviously, that's how we arrive at the carried interest in real estate, which is really what we're going to be talking about today. Today's episode can be seen as a real estate specific episode, but keep in mind, this also applies broadly to all sorts of private equity and hedge funds. So these are concepts that I'd say more recently have made their way into real estate, especially with the hyper financialization of real estate that we've seen very recently in the last, you know, decade. You see how real estate has become I don't want to throw around the term easy, but like there was a couple years, and we can all admit in the last few years, it seemed like everybody was succeeding in real estate just by getting high degree of leverage, deploying it into cash flowing assets, and then the carried interest was almost a guaranteed win, depending on what your investor terms were. So I think that really gets us up to speed with today and how we see carried interest and the prevalence we have of it today.
It's kind of an interesting concept if you really think about it and you think about how it has progressed over time. This concept of, I don't want to put much or any money in the deal, so how do we align interests if I'm the one that's going to do all the work and you're the one that's going to finance it? And that's really what a carry has been born out of. So talk to us about the key features of a carried interest. You've got a few listed here called crystallization, the clawback provision, the vesting periods, and then the catch-up provision. Talk to us about those.
Yeah. So all of those that you just mentioned are going to be features that the manager is going to be pretty concerned about. And a lot of them actually, they were birthed by the managers. Like the managers were the ones that came up with these. So a lot of these can be seen as manager favorable, but also they do serve a strong utility. And I would argue that a lot of them also go towards aligning the interests. So let's just go down that list and start with crystallization, because that's one that really is like a buzzword. And a lot of people hear that and they want to hear more about it because they've heard their friends who are private equity managers or hedge fund managers throw around the term crystallization. So that's a pretty key one. And really, that's just a feature that gives the holder of the carried interest a right to kind of lock in upside that they've generated. So if we start on day one and a carried interest is a right in the future profits of an endeavor, doesn't have any value today, but if you do well, it will have value at some future point. The crystallization happens at that future point when the value has been created. So it captures that increased value at the future date by converting it into a straight percentage or a partnership interest based on the value of that partnership's property at the time of the crystallization. So yeah, that's how it's really locking in and solidifying that manager, that GP's position. One application we see this a lot is when, you know, if somebody has a carried interest in a deal that's going to be held a very long time, but a lot of that appreciation happens relatively quickly on the front end, right? So in real estate, let's say that you've got a carried interest in a development deal, but the plan isn't to sell the development afterwards, it's to hold it indefinitely. So you might receive a carried interest, but then on the date of stabilization, whatever that's defined, you know, that can be defined a number of ways, but let's say it's, you know, let's call it 24 months after COO to keep it really a certificate of occupancy, to keep it really simple. Then at that date, it's written in the operating agreement, we take a look at the value of the partnership, and then we give that carried interest an assigned value based on the pre-crystallization terms. And then boom, rather than calling it a carried interest anymore, that converts into a fully vested capital interest. And then they're pretty much in line with all the other investors.
Yeah. And if you're listening to this thinking, how do you determine the valuation? Typically, that will be discussed and determined upfront in the terms of the operating agreement.
Right.
So it's not typically some, I mean, you can always renegotiate it, but it's not something that you would typically fight about 24 months into the deal. So talk about the clawback provision. What is that?
So this one gets a little bit nuanced, because a simple carried interest is when you don't receive, as the carried interest holder or as the GP, you don't receive any distributions until the investors have received their entire amount of their investment plus any preferred return and so on and so forth. So you're really the last dollar received. Then a clawback provision really isn't that necessary. A clawback provision is those other instances where a carried interest might be written in a more complex manner. So for example, let's say that a carried interest is written to say, you know, throughout the life of the deal, the carried interest holder can receive 20% of the operating cash flows even before the investors have been paid off on their initial investment. And then on the back end, when whatever the underlying assets of the deal, in our case, probably real estate, when that's sold, then that proceeds is went to pay back the original investors. And then the remainder is then back to the 80-20 or the 20% carry. So now imagine a scenario where you as the GP, you're receiving distributions on your interim carry on the cash flow. But then when you went to sell the deal down the road, the sale didn't actually generate enough proceeds to pay back the investors. A clawback provision says, okay, whoever was holding that carried interest and received those distributions in the interim actually has to pay them back, because when this all shook out down the road, they probably shouldn't have received them in the first place, because the overall economics of the deal didn't lend to any upside, even though they were being paid like it was out of the upside. So that's the simplest way to think about that is to just, it's kind of that peace of mind to the investor to say, all right, sure, I'll give the operator or the manager some upside now on the good faith that down the road, we'll receive our investment back. But if not, then I get some of that, what we've paid them in the interim, back.
And the opposite of a claw back provision is probably a catch up provision. So how does that work?
Exactly. Yeah. So there's a couple different things about catch ups that, I mean, there's different types of catch ups, but a typical catch up would be somewhere where, let's say in a simple scenario, the investors are paid back their return, and then it's an 80-20 split, right, between the investors and the carried interest holder. Now, in some instances, a catch-up would be inserted to say, after the investors are receiving their initial investment back, then all of the distributions would go to the carried interest holder up until the aggregate amount of distributions is equal to 80-20. So it's just like a little time period between when they're paid back to when it's splitting between the upside going 80 and 20 between all of the investors and the GP. It's just so that at the end of the day, assuming there is enough upside, that the overall distributions will equal 80-20, as opposed to some lesser defined split of paying back the investors first and then just 80-20 from there on out. Did that answer your question? I think that there's a lot of different ways to think about the catch up.
It did. No, it did. And the last feature that we want to talk about are the vesting periods that you can add to carried interest. And investing is like anything else, right? Like if you work in a company and you have equity that vests, once you hit certain thresholds, you have the ability to access that next tranche. But I'm curious to know from you, what are some examples of this that you've seen in operating agreements? Where do people use, or how do people use vesting as a feature for that carried interest provision?
So there's two main ways. The first would be in tandem with the crystallization. And so you can see the vesting period is almost like just a time period before a crystallization happens. So maybe you just have a straight carried interest in the deal. And then after a vesting period passes, usually linked to tenure as a manager and employee or something of the sort, after the vesting period passes, then a crystallization event occurs. So that's not typically what vesting means, but I see it used a lot in that context. The true meaning of vesting, the way I see it at least, would have nothing to do with the crystallization. It actually has to do with just purely being entitled to the carried interest in the first place. And so imagine on day one, when we do this deal, I receive a carried interest that's worthless, but then a year down the road, it becomes very valuable. And my share of the upside is, let's call it $1 million. Maybe without a vesting period, I'm fully entitled to that $1 million at that time. In that value, I'm entitled to it, right? I could, in theory, maybe sell that to somebody and be entitled to the proceeds. Maybe in a prudent scenario where you're trying to make the manager's time horizon a little bit longer, longer sighted, you would attach a vesting period to that to say, sure, here is the value at that time, but you're not entitled to that value until you've been a manager and employed in this entity for 3 years. So sure, you can calculate the value, like the accrued value that you have in the carried interest, but you're not entitled to it. You cannot possibly receive it until you've been a manager here for 36 months. That would be, in my eyes, the other time you'd see vesting periods. And it's typically associated with like a key employee or a grant of profits interest to somebody who is, you know, doing services, and that you want them to continue to do those services for a period of time.
I think for newer investors, I'll say accredited investors, I think sometimes a carry is difficult to comprehend. Like, why would I pay so much to the manager of this deal on the back end? Why is the carried interest good? You keep saying it like aligns interests with the investors and the managers. Let's like really talk in layman's terms here, though. Why is the carried interest good for both parties?
So I see it as, first thing we have to acknowledge is no manager is going to do a good job if they're working for free. You have to pay them somehow, right? So you're really faced with the decision. You have to decide what's reasonable to pay this person for their efforts. Sure, that's one consideration. But the other consideration is, how should that payment be made and what should it be linked to? Because I think the alternative to a carry, a very simple thing that a lot of people could understand, would be just to pay them a fee, either an asset management fee or an acquisition fee, something of the sort where you're just saying, I will pay you $500,000 to be the manager of this entity, right? Well, once that fee is kind of hit their bank account, in a sense, what incentive do they have to continue to perform at the level that they promised? Whereas in a carried interest scenario, where the payment is contingent upon performing really well for the investors. So put differently, you cannot even tap, like a manager cannot receive a carried interest until you've got your money back, and in a lot of cases, pretty reasonable return on that money. So we see 8%, we see 10%. These are preferred returns where if written into the operating agreement, you'd be entitled to receive that before the carried interest is worth anything. That's a lot easier to stomach, I would say, in the sense where you just want your manager to be paid based on value that they've actually created for you, for the other investors, right? And I would also argue that, yes, in a sense, carried interest in that, in those cases, might end up being higher than if you were to just agree to a fee. But I would say the size of the carried interest was also just indicative of the amount of value they were able to create. So that would be my thought around that.
Yeah, because the larger the carry on the back end, the, I don't want to say like the more certainty you're going to have that your return is going to be hit, because that's not necessarily true. But the more that you incentivize a result, the more likely you are to get the result, right? So right. A carried interest is a great thing. That's why real estate funds use them, syndicates use them. That's why private equity companies use them, investment companies use them, because they're really trying to drive the managers to achieve a certain return for the investors that the investors are happy with, and then splitting everything after that. So don't shy away from a carry.
Yeah. Yeah. We see a graduated carry in a lot of instances too, where as the return sent back to the investors gets more favorable, the amount of the carry percentage that the manager can receive increases. And so it could be something where they're only receiving a 20% carry, but if they're able to get the investors, let's say 18% return on their investment as opposed to 12%, and I'm just making these numbers up, but like if it was 18%, above and beyond that, well, then they get 40 or 50%. We see that all the time. And those are called hurdles. And that's when you start to get in more into the complex waterfalls. So obviously we could do a podcast on waterfalls aside from just carried interest. But just as far as carried interest go, those are some of the conversations you start to have and some of the maneuvers you can start to make.
So let's talk about the tax implications of a carried interest. Now, I know that there's a lot of discussion around the tax implications of a carried interest. So hopefully we can set the record straight here. In the world of taxes, what is a carried interest? What do we actually call it?
Well, a carried interest is a profits interest, first of all, in the world of tax. And so we can attack this from two angles. And I'm going to start with what is it in terms of a profits interest, and then we'll get into the nuances of 1061, code section 1061. But let's just start with profits interest, because profits interest is a defined term. We hear about it in the revenue procedures, specifically revenue procedure 93-27, which means it was released in 1993. And then it was further clarified in 2001 with revenue procedure 2001-43. And so a profits interest is, it's a really simple definition for a tax person to understand, because it's anything that's not a capital interest, right? Okay, what the heck does that mean? To put it in layman's terms, a profits interest, it's something specifically designated as an interest in future profits of a partnership, but that does not include the right to any of the partnership's capital upon exit. And so to put that differently, it comes back to that same scenario of let's just launch a new investment where it's $1 million invested by Brandon and I'm just going to manage it for a 20% carry. On day one, when I receive that carried interest, I have to pay back Brandon the full $1 million he invested. So if he invested $1 million and then the next day we liquidated, it would go right back to him. I'm not going to get anything out of the deal, so it's worth nothing today. That's the essence of what a profits interest is. I can only have any value by generating upside. So that's not returning capital of the investments made. That's a return on investment. That's a profit generated in the partnership. And that's right in the name, profits interest. So you have an interest in the profits generated. You don't have an interest in the capital contributed. That would be a capital interest. So that's just the basic definition. And you can go to RevProc 93-27 and then 2001-43 for kind of those deeper nuances, but that's what you'll find.
Awesome. Awesome. And so if you go into section 1061, what do we find there?
Well, so backing up a little bit, so the receipt of a profits interest is not taxable on day one to the extent that the fair market value is not discernible on day one. Right. So a profits interest on its receipt, not taxable on day one, it's only taxable on the back end. So how do we link that to 1061, which is a code section for how profits interest and carried interest in general are treated on the back end? So what do I mean by taxed on the back end? Well, if you're not receiving any taxable income for the receipt of a profit's interest when received, but there is upside generated, and at some point you'll either receive a K-1 or some sort of liquidating distribution that triggers a gain, 1061 tells us how that is to be treated when that happens in the future and what tax rate is to be applied. So 1061 of the Internal Revenue Code modifies actually the taxation of carried interest by extending the holding period requirement for long-term capital gains to 3 years instead of one. So why is that relevant? Let's say I'm a hedge fund manager and the assets in the hedge fund are predominantly, you know, stocks and bonds or private investments in businesses, for example. And I've generated a lot of upside in this hedge fund. And after 2 years, the hedge fund liquidates and has a whole bunch of long-term capital gain that's distributed out to all of the investors. And all of the investors pay long-term capital gain tax on that. And I receive a K-1 that has a lot of long-term capital gain as a result as well, because of all the upside we generated and I was entitled to a portion of that. It sounds great because it sounds like I'm a hedge fund manager who just put in a lot of effort and got compensated really well. And then my compensation is subject to 20% long-term capital gains tax rate. Section 1061 attempts to put a stop to that. And it says, to the extent that you, as the general partner, or as the hedge fund manager or private equity manager, whatever your title is, to the extent that you have not held the interest for greater than 3 years in this applicable partnership interest, is what they call it, you actually need to recharacterize that upside, that gain, and it has to become ordinary income taxed at the ordinary income tax rate at up to 37% for federal, and then whatever your state rate is as well. And so it's kind of punitive towards those folks who are trying to benefit from the long-term capital gain treatment from the carried interest.
That's a lot.
I know.
So if somebody's listening to this, how can they structure to be the most tax advantageous as possible for their deal?
Sure. Well, there's a couple answers to that, because I'll start by giving the generic answer before we get into the real estate specific answer. The generic answer is simple in the sense of a hedge fund. It's to hold your interest for longer than 3 years, because to the extent you're receiving allocations of gain prior to that 3-year mark, well, you really don't have a lot of structuring opportunity to get around that. However, as with most things in tax, there's this big exception. So 1061, the code section we were just talking about, doesn't apply to certain types of gain triggered. Those gains are called 1231 gains, but those are the types of gains that are triggered when you sell real estate assets or any assets used in a business sense. So real estate assets fall under that. So it actually turns out that though 1061 has huge implications for hedge fund managers and those investing in private equity deals and private business, it's actually pretty much a big carve-out exception for anybody dealing specifically in real estate to say 1061 doesn't apply, because 1061 doesn't apply to the types of gains generated in real estate. So our listeners who are large real estate operators who have carried interests, who were just freaking out about 1061, can actually take a sigh of relief, because 1061 doesn't apply to the types of gains that they're likely to be triggering. Of course, if you're doing a deal and getting out of it within a year, you're still going to have short-term capital gain, but you don't have to worry about the recharacterization of long-term capital gain if you don't hold it for 3 years. So that's an added benefit that we see across the tax code of operating within real estate.
So love that explanation. And I guess I'll ask the second part of my question again is, if I'm a GP launching a fund or a syndicate, how can I ensure that my carry is structured in a way that I can optimize, right? So that I avoid potential tax problems.
Got it. Okay. So we have a kind of a list here of things that I'd like to go over. And I have a couple examples of things that I've seen in the past where this has arisen. But the first thing on my list is, you know, this is simple. You want to make sure that your liquidating distributions are arranged such that you do not receive liquidation value on the receipt of the interest. So that goes back to that example we were already talking about. As long as your operating agreement is written to substantiate that, that's a good thing for you. So the way that that's typically done is in the liquidating provision. Every operating agreement has one. You have to define how distributions are sent out in the event of a liquidation. It's just as simple as making sure that investors are paid back their capital first, so it could not be construed as you as a carried interest holder receiving somebody else's invested capital. That would present a problem and potentially present a lot of tax implications. And then on that same vein, if you plan to receive distributions before invested capital is returned, kind of like another example we were talking about earlier, where sometimes you can have interim distributions received, you better make sure that the distribution language in the operating agreement is bifurcated and very well defined to say that's allowed for operations, but for liquidation, it's still very important that the investors are paid back their capital, because it just keeps coming back to, okay, you would have taxable compensation or some form of tax hit if you received a capital interest and were suddenly and immediately entitled to some return of capital that you didn't put in. On that same vein, as it relates to both the liquidating distribution and operating distribution provision, and kind of really clarifying in the operating agreement that you're not entitled to those return of capital, I think another third thing that some people do, it goes back to the clawback provision that we mentioned earlier. They'll actually include a clawback provision in the operating agreement to basically just sit there and say, in avoidance of doubt, even if we somehow were entitled to some capital invested in the interim based on the other two provisions we just mentioned, we will return any of those distributions to the extent that we cannot repay our investors. So those three kind of working in tandem together are ways that people can avoid a lot of problems with their carried interest. Those come up a lot. I'd say a lot of folks are hesitant to have clawbacks included in their operating agreement. And I can understand why, right? So as long as the first two are really well defined, I think that that's a baseline. But clawbacks are kind of that last thing to really put the nail in the coffin and say, I genuinely intend for this to not have any tax impact on me on day one. And so those are the three things that relate to liquidating distributions.
So for those three things, you know, if I'm a GP listening to this, I'm wondering, does my attorney cover that? Or do I need a CPA to take a look at that? Do attorneys understand how the language that they include related to liquidating distributions or operating distributions, how that impacts the taxation of a carry?
I'd say the majority of attorneys may understand conceptually a portion of it. But when it comes to refining the language in the operating agreement, I do think that that's something that you especially should have a CPA take a look at, just because that's the type of thing a CPA is really going to be paying attention to the most and have the most background knowledge and research on. So an attorney is really good when it comes to, you know, as we know, liability and risk mitigation, and writing a PPM that aligns with the economics of a deal. And maybe if you have a really solid attorney, they have really solid distribution provisions as well. The issue may arise when it comes to looking at that distribution section in tandem with the allocation section and really understanding, okay, if liquidating distributions, for example, we see this a lot, they might be written in terms of liquidate in positive capital account, like liquidate it in accordance with positive capital accounts. Well, that's pretty boilerplate language that an attorney might throw in there, and it makes sense. But when you really run the numbers and then you take a look at, okay, what results in a positive capital account, and you find something in the allocation section that, oh, it looks like this carried interest owner is actually entitled to a positive capital account on day one. And so therefore, by combining those two, and this is an example of something I actually saw in practice recently, there was a provision in an operating agreement that a manager of a relatively large portfolio, there was actually to be a valuation done on the first day, assigning a dollar amount to the carried interest that they could receive in liquidation. And it was just, I think it was just a leftover artifact from another boilerplate operating agreement, because I could tell that that wasn't their intention with the economics. But if you were to follow the operating agreement to a T and really look at the methods that they were using to calculate the carried interest, and there was like this, on every third year, there was another revaluation that was taking place, and it was written to be a taxable revaluation. So every third year, they would reassess the value of their carried interest, and they would be granted additional capital interests. Well, that's about as inefficient as you could possibly be in terms of a carried interest. And that's just one example. We see that all the time, though, where it's really well-intentioned. The distribution section makes a whole lot of sense. But then when paired with the allocations, or in some cases, other provisions such as contributions and distributions or the granting of this interest, it can get a little bit to it.
Yeah. So in summary, the attorneys are really good. You might be okay, but if you really want to cross your T's, dot your I's, loop your CPA into this conversation so that you just don't end up with a bunch of surprises at some later point. All right. The last piece here was how to avoid tax problems related to structuring crystallizations. Do you want to talk about that?
Absolutely. So crystallizations, we've already kind of talked about what a crystallization is. It really locks in your value at a certain future point in time. But when you have a crystallization, it's usually linked to some sort of event. And the code is very particular, the tax code that is very particular about which events can relate to a crystallization and result in a bookup. So there's a lot of technical jargon, but the summary is that in real estate, we've got a lot of instances where we're passing through losses, and losses are very valuable to both GPs and LPs alike, especially though GPs who are materially participating real estate professionals. And a GP may want to receive some of those losses. And a lot of times a crystallization event related to stabilization, for example, will entitle a GP to a capital interest in the partnership and thereby possibly entitling them to a lot of losses. That's at least how a lot of GPs anticipate and hope for it. But there's a big asterisk right next to that that says, okay, one can only be entitled to these losses if there's a valid bookup in place, which the technical jargon here is a code 704C built-in gain that's a result of a revaluation or a crystallization. So it'd be great if crystallizations could always result in bookups. And then GPs could just say on a certificate of occupancy, I receive a bookup and that gives me a big fat capital account by which I can take losses against. However, in the current regulations, certificate of occupancy is not an instance where there would be an allowable bookup. Bookups are only supposed to be linked to things, and I've got a list here. So the typical list would be contributions of money or property, the liquidation of a partnership or distribution of money or property, or the grant of interest in a partnership as consideration for the provision of services or for the benefit of the partnership by an existing or new partner. And so that sounds like that could be our golden ticket, but remember, that didn't happen at the certificate of occupancy. That happened well before the certificate of occupancy. So unless we're bringing on new GPs or something of the sort on the day of the certificate of occupancy, we're not going to be able to do kind of a bookup in that sense. So it really does present some key questions about, okay, well, what should we be doing to, you know, structure our deals so that we can get a crystallization event that is eligible for a bookup, but at the optimal time? Mm-hmm. And so we see a lot of people doing that right around refinances, because that would be a reasonable time to do a bookup, at least by my logic. And that's helpful because that gives a GP potentially a vested capital interest that they could take a tax-free distribution against from the refinance, as opposed to potentially getting proceeds from their finance that are taxable. So that's just one example of an area where that should be a consideration.
Well, that's a lot of information on a carried interest. I think we're at the 41-minute mark right now. So we've talked a lot. Well, I guess we had a little bit of an intro, but, you know, 35 minutes talking about carried interest provisions. And I'm sure we could go on forever because there's a lot more information here. But hopefully, if you're listening, this is a good high-level primer on how to structure your carried interest, how to avoid tax traps, what the point of a carried interest is, and why it's beneficial to both the operators and the investors. Is there anything else we want to say before we close out?
That sums it up for me, Brandon. I think that carried interests are just going to become more and more prevalent. So the more we can understand, and if the IRS is listening, please, let's get some more clarity around crystallizations, mm-hmm. because that's one area where it just seems like we're kind of operating off of very limited information. So that's a message to our IRS listeners out there and our enforcement agents out there. So please do chime in.
Dylan, appreciate you lending your brain to this conversation. Everybody listening, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to the Major League Real Estate Podcast. There are three ways that you can connect with us. If you're interested in getting email updates on upcoming shows, go to www.mlrepodcast.com and subscribe there. If you'd like to explore a tax and accounting relationship with our CPA firm, you can go to www.therealestatecpa.com/MLRE and fill out the web form to get started. And if you'd like to connect with Dylan or I on social media, you can find us on LinkedIn and Twitter. Just search Dylan Brown CPA or Brandon Hall CPA. Shoot us a request. We'd love to connect. We'll see you next time.